Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today on the program, I'll be speaking with two guests, Australian politician and environmental activist Senator Bob Brown and Frank Rich, author and New York Times columnist. Frank Rich's latest book is titled The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina, published by Penguin Press in 2006. He's written three other books, including his childhood memoir, Ghostlight, published by Random House in 2000. Prior to his position as an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Frank served as a chief drama critic beginning in 1980. In 2005, he received the George Polk Award for commentary. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I feel very honoured that you should consent to do this interview, Frank. I think you're the one of the few people who've had the courage to really get stuck into the Bush administration and its fabric of lies that has gone on for the last 8 years. I think the way you describe how the Bush administration orchestrated its, quotes, policy using all the latest attributes of the media and theatre is absolutely fascinating. And of course, you being a theatre critic, you've been able to dissect that. Would you like to just expound a little upon that, Frank?
Well, sure. I think that, you know, when history looks back at the Bush administration, one thing that this White House did extremely well and in a very calculating way was to use, in the biggest sense of the word, theater to sell its policies, including those policies which were in some cases, such as the Iraq War, based on fictional premises.
Mm-hmm.
Bush was although Ronald Reagan was a professional actor, Bush was a very good performer for these pageants that were put on, and almost everything in the first 4 or 5 years of his presidency before it began to fall apart was cunningly and immaculately staged for him to be the starring role. And as I talk about in my book, they even stage managed trivial things. For instance, shortly before Bush decided to run for president, he and his wife bought a house in rural Texas that was a, you know, they built it themselves. They had it built. It was a modern, eco-friendly house that a rich person in Texas might have. And yet, they branded it as a ranch. They called it a ranch. They had photo opportunities where Bush would appear at the so-called ranch and be clearing brush.
Mm-hmm.
A ranch is defined by having cattle and, you know, livestock. There were no livestock. It wasn't a ranch. It was just a rich person's country home, but it was part of a theatrical attempt to portray him as a man of the people, which is quite a feat, and they accomplished it given that he's from one of the wealthiest and most aristocratic families in America, and that he himself is the product of three of the most elite schools in America, Andover, Yale, and Harvard. But that's the kind of care they did for everything. They built sets during the war in Iraq, in Qatar, where the Central Command would hold press conferences. They had a $250,000 set built and shipped there from America, designed by the same designer who designed Good Morning America, one of the network chat shows.
Really?
And then, of course, as the world saw, there was the pageantry of Mission Accomplished, which ultimately would blow up in his face. But that was a beautifully planned show from the moment Bush landed in a plane and a jet on the carrier's deck to the hoisting of that banner to the costumes of the troops that were there that were special dress costumes. They fought the way Hollywood did, and it paid off for them for a long time. Once ever the public stopped believing it, then it didn't matter.
No. Frank, I've often wondered, did Bush really fly that plane? Because in the Texas Air Force Guard, he really didn't accomplish all the hours he needed for Air Force training. He hadn't flown a plane for ages. Did he actually fly that plane?
He claims to have. I can't answer that question. I don't know. You know, he certainly wasn't in the cockpit alone. We don't know. The real point, though, was to convey the feeling that he had been a fighter pilot during his own military service, when, of course, he hadn't been. He had indeed flown planes, but all of them were in America. He did not serve in Vietnam.
Never went near any fighting.
No.
Who were the people, Frank, behind this extraordinary theatrical production of the Bush administration? I know that Karl Rove played a major role, probably in orchestrating it, but who were the people behind it? Who sold their souls to do this?
You know, they're not famous names, but the White House had on staff former television news producers. For instance, in the case of Mission Accomplished, they sent at least a couple of these guys who were, you know, lighting men, cameramen, onto the USS Abraham Lincoln a couple of days early to set it all up. And there were a number of people in the administration who were practiced at public relations, in addition to Karl Rove, such as Karen Hughes, who was his spokesman for a period of time, or main communications advisor. Also, his chief of staff, Andrew Card, had been the PR man for the big three Detroit auto companies in private life. So he also came from a background of being in public relations.
Yes, wasn't it Clark who said, Andrew Clark's explanation for why the administration delayed making its case against Iraq until September 2002, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August.
Right, it was Andrew Card who said that, and Card gave that interview just before Labor Day in America late summer of 2002. As we now know, they had the product ready to go, because we know from the so-called Downing Street memo that a group had been convening in the White House that summer that was determined to enforce a policy of going to war, whatever the intelligence might say to the contrary. And we also know that it was a week or two after Card made that statement in an interview to Elizabeth Buemiller, a White House correspondent at the Times, in fact, that they started rolling out all their language about mushroom clouds, and smoking guns, and pumping up the nuclear threat in particular that they said that Saddam Hussein represented to America.
Yes, it's really terrifying to me to think that the media in America, who you would imagine would be some of the best journalists in the world, the way they went along with this administration in its lies and its deception, and in fact, how they helped to orchestrate the war. And I hate to say this, but Judith Miller was one of the main ones, I think, with her five front page articles in the New York Times, being close to Louis Libby and Chalabi and the rest. I mean, I guess it makes my blood run cold to think that the journalists of America participated in this intrigue and this fabric of lies that led, in fact, to the death we think now of maybe more than a million civilians in Iraq. And you, Frank, I think, were one of the few people who was trying to break through this fabric of lies to present the truth to the American people.
Well, this is not a great chapter in the history of American journalism. There were some reporters, including at the Times, who tried to get it right and to some extent did penetrate what was going on. It was also true to some extent at the Washington Post. However, as the Times itself would write in its own mea culpa about what went on in the run-up to war in Iraq, often the stories that were accurate were underplayed or way back in the paper. and that was also true with the Washington Post. The television network didn't even make any, as far as I could tell, made no attempt to question anything. What was this about? I think there are a lot of great journalists here, and I think that places, institutions like the Times and the Post, at least, have been very chagrined by the performance during that period, and all sorts of safeguards, and for that matter, personnel changes have taken place since then. The whole news operation is run in a different way, and largely by different people since that happened. So it's not as if this escaped our notice. But I think I also want to point out there was a couple of reporters in the Washington Bureau of what was then called the Knight Ritter chain of newspapers. It subsequently was sold. It's now known as McClatchy Newspapers, that were right all the way along and had the stories all the way along. But because the main Knight Ritter papers were in cities like Miami and Philadelphia, they were off the access of New York and Washington, the main sort of media establishment. They went unheralded and little noticed, sadly. That doesn't, but that helps explain the way also what the atmosphere was.
What brought about this incredible enabling by the media at the highest levels, the editors, the publishers, to allow the Bush administration to perpetrate, and I have to say this guardedly and carefully, such evil? I mean, looking at it from an outside perspective, but even inside, I can't really get my head around why this was allowed to happen, Frank.
Well, I think the reason why it may be hard for you to understand, but it's a little bit easier to understand in America, is America was attacked, you know, and you cannot begin to understand what that felt like. I fear, you know, be in New York or Washington on 9/11, it was a real shock to the system, and it scared the hell out of people. I think that there was a natural feeling, journalists are citizens too, there's a natural feeling of wanting to circle around your country's leaders when a country has been attacked. And indeed, Bush had a 90% plus approval rating in the weeks and months, first few months after 9/11. And the, you know, the press are human beings, and I think they wanted to give this president, who was little known and very untested at that point, and you know, less than a year into his term, the benefit of the doubt. I think that what the problem is, at a certain point, the press has to go back to being skeptical and doing its job. It never quite did. And part of it was a kind of inertia sat in. Part of it was fear. I think that the administration liked to bully the press, liked to bully a lot of people, and it intimidated certain parts of the press from fearing of being called unpatriotic. I do not think that's what happened at the Times and the Washington Post and some of the top news organizations. I think what happened there was a little bit of jingoism, but a lot more of just sloppiness and being bamboozled and people letting their guard down. We just didn't have, in retrospect, the checks and balances that we should have on sourcing. And that's the big thing that's been cleaned up. I think the fear component is much more apparent in the TV network, which never did any investigative reporting about Iraq, never even tried to, never had reporters like James Risen of the New York Times or Walter Pincus of the Washington Post or Seymour Hersh of the New Yorker, who did get a lot of the story right, or people at Knight Ritter. So that's what happened. But you can't, it's hard to maybe sit in Australia and picture what the atmosphere was like in America when in Manhattan 3,000 people were killed in a single morning and the two biggest buildings fall down.
Well, Frank, I actually was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin when the attack occurred. I'd flown in to speak to thousands of students at the University of Wisconsin, and I woke up in the morning and saw the planes fly in, and then I actually had to take a Greyhound bus all across America about 3 days later. I was supposed to fly to Paris but couldn't fly. And all across America, it was swathed in flags, And at the little mum and pop stores, there were signs everywhere saying, God bless America. And I had a sense of foreboding that this could or would be used by the administration and the powers that be for vengeance rather than to, it was a very Christian area where I was speaking. And so to give the speech that night, I got out the Bible and as read what Jesus said, love thine enemies and do good to those who hate you, hoping that that tack would be taken in a diplomatic way. But of course, we know that the administration used this opportunity to do what they had planned to do for a long time, right, Frank?
Well, I'm not so convinced of the last part of what you said. I don't think, I don't believe that that Bush had planned to go to war in Iraq mm-hmm. before 9/11. I believe that there were people around him who for years, long before the Bush administration, had been wanting to go back and take out Saddam. That's without question. But if you look at the record prior, during the 2000 campaign, and even prior to 9/11, you find that there was no real interest in the Bush part. Bush was not a neoconservative. You also find Bush campaigned against the whole idea of nation building, and literally, I think a week, without having my book in front of me, but I write about this in my book so you can see for yourself, before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld gave a big policy speech in New York titled Against Nation Building. What I think happened is after the 9/11 attack, we went to war in Afghanistan to go after the people who had actually attacked us, and that war was won, or I put one in quotes, thought to be won at the time. We had routed the Taliban by Thanksgiving, by late November, early December of 2001. And my own feeling is that they lost Osama bin Laden in Bora Bora, and they were looking for some action, and this was something they sort of took off the shelf because they thought it wouldn't involve nation building. They thought it would be easy. They thought it'd be like the British going into Grenada,
mm-hmm.
and they thought it was a way to sort of extend a war presidency that was very successful and sort of go in and take out a dictator that, let's face it, is a thug and a mass murderer, and be home by Christmas. Instead, of course, they didn't do their homework. And once they were in, they fell into quicksand. And I don't think Bush was manipulated. I think it was Bush's decision. I don't believe that, in the whole line that Cheney told him what to do or anything of the kind. But I think that he was sold it. He was not sold it before. He had no intention of doing it at the time he was elected or before 9/11. I think something happened that changed his mind, and I've always felt some of it was domestic politics and riding this wave. Something happened in late 2001, early 2002 that made him go in this direction. He had been resisting entreaties like this by the Wolfowitz crowd and so on for months, according to most accounts that we have of it.
I'm interviewing Frank Rich, a journalist at the New York Times. Yes, but what about the people, the Project for a New American Century, and the power and control or influence they had, such as Richard Perle and Feith and Wolfowitz and Woolsey, and Rumsfeld was one of them, I think, and Cheney definitely was. They had been wanting for some time, had they not, to go into Iraq, and
some of those, yes, some of them, no. I don't think Rumsfeld fits in that category. Richard Perle, certainly, but he was, yes, there were all these neoconservatives around the Republican Party. Some of them, like Perle, didn't really have positions in the Bush administration, or they were on minor advisory boards. They had certainly been campaigning for it. They've been campaigning for it since the previous Bush administration, when, that many of them were very angry that Bush Sr. had not taken, marched to Baghdad and taken Hussein out. All that's true. All I'm saying is there's no evidence to suggest that I know of. You may know something that I'm unaware of, that this was a premeditated, that this was actually the plan of the Bush administration when it took off.
Well, that's very interesting, and I'm glad you elucidated that for me and for our listeners. I'd like to move on to the crafting of stories, because I think it's fascinating your contrapuntal sort of attitude towards the media and being part of the media, yet having been associated with the theatre for so long. The embedded journalists who agreed to go under Pentagon sort of control to cover the Iraq war, the role that the Pentagon, that Hollywood plays with the Pentagon in the production of its movies, and also the fact that the Pentagon placed in the media until very recently very high up retired military officials to promote their line about Iraq and the like. Would you like to, I know that's a big agenda, Frank, but would you like to comment upon some of that?
Well, the Times in the past year, or I'm not exactly precise on the date, but I'd say maybe even in the past 6 to 8 months, has done several pieces that suggest that many of the sort of retired military people that appear as commentators on network television, and not just in the Bush years, but especially in the Bush years since we were at war, are not... Some of them are carrying the water for the Bush administration, which is no surprise. What was even more surprising was how many of them had contracts or were consultants to military contractors who had business interests in American, weapon procurement and military spending. And the Times, and I heartily suggest people seek this. It's all available on the New York Times, nytimes.com website. Will be startled to read these lengthy descriptions. As far as the synergy between Hollywood and the Pentagon, that goes back, to World War II. Uh-huh. There's always been between the movie and television industries collaborations. I think they're ridiculous, but they've happened between government and filmmakers. When I was a child growing up, in the 50s and 60s, there was a weekly television show about the FBI where, like J. Edgar Hoover was thanked, a notorious and vindictive and somewhat corrupt FBI founder and director, was like thanked at the end of every episode. It was pure propaganda. So this is nothing new. There may actually be less of it now, in part because war movies aren't very popular. There are not so many made. It's not like it was during World War II or even in the 50s. We're not in a John Wayne era, so not so many of those movies are being made. There was and I write about this in my book. There was a very strange collaboration between a well-known Hollywood producer and the Pentagon on producing a series that was about the fighting in Afghanistan for the ABC television network. And it was particularly ridiculous because ABC News, the news division of this network, which is owned by Disney, couldn't get access to the front, but the entertainment division producing this sort of cheesy show with Pentagon cooperation did get the Pentagon loud in the front. That said, the show was a complete flop. Almost no one saw it. It was canceled after 6 or 7 weeks. It didn't fool anybody.
Mm. I'm interviewing Frank Rich, a journalist at the New York Times. Frank, you write so extensively on so many things, and we haven't got time to cover nearly as much as I wanted to, but now we have a new president. Would you like to prognosticate about the attitudes of the new administration and the influence it will have upon the huge numbers of issues that need to be addressed, but specifically the sort of, should I use this word, warmongering the corruption in the Pentagon, about which you write very succinctly, and where you think the United States will go in helping to lead the world in a new direction.
You know, I can't. What I can say is, you know, let's give him a chance and see what he's going to do. He ran a campaign that was clearly based on an enormous break with what the Bush administration has been doing both at home and abroad. And we have to hope that he is going to be a president that thinks first and uses diplomacy first before acting like a cowboy. That said, we just don't know. And he's taking over in a very, very difficult period in American life because of the meltdown of the economy, which is certainly the biggest economic crisis of my lifetime, of Barack Obama's lifetime, of most Americans' lifetime. And it's very unusual circumstances. He's inherited a complete mess on almost every front from his predecessor because, you know, international listeners may not be aware of the extent of which there's a whole group of secondary scandals that have nothing to do with foreign policy that Obama also has to clean up. Corruption in the Interior Department, the politicization of the Justice Department. Everyone knows about torture, about rendition, about the Bush foreign policy. Everyone knows about Bush's mismanagement and sort of absentee management of the economy. But there's tons of other problems in almost every department of government with political hacks having been inserted there by him. And it's a real mess. And it's a mess as money is running out. So I think we all have to hope for the best for the new president and give him a little bit of a chance here.
To close, I just loved the photograph on the front of the New York Times today of Bush leaving his last press conference and the look on Helen Thomas's face as he left the press room.
Priceless. It was indeed. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to do it.
Thank you for talking to us and giving us some of your absolutely fascinating insights. And the one column I never miss every week is your column, Frank, on Sundays.
Well, that's very lovely of you. Thank you so much, and take care, and have a good new year, and here's to better times.
Here's to better times. We'll be staying up all night to watch the inauguration here in Australia.
That's wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
We'll be staying up all night here, too.
I'm sure you will. Have a ball, Frank.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye-bye. My guest today was author and New York Times columnist Frank Rich. To read Frank's past columns or to buy his books, go to frankrich.com. As Frank Rich and I have been discussing, President Obama is about to lead us into a new era of politics and diplomatic global communication. And people around the world who've been warning of the consequences of climate change for years now have a new sense of hope. One of those people on the opposite side of the world in Australia is Senator Bob Brown, the current leader of the Australian Greens, our third largest political party. Bob Brown was first elected to represent the state of Tasmania in the Australian Senate in 1996, and since then he's fought tirelessly for social justice and environmental protection. In the early 80s, he spent 19 days in prison while he was head of the Wilderness Society for his involvement in the blockade of the dam works at Tasmania's Franklin River. Bob is a doctor, a physician, and he sat in a tree for 2 weeks in his suit in a very dignified fashion, giving interviews to the media about saving this wonderful wild river. And it was so attractive that he attracted thousands of Australians from all over the country, elderly retirees, you name it, to come down, and the Franklin River was actually saved. Bob Brown, as I said, has a degree in medicine from the University of Sydney. He's also an author and an accomplished photographer. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be talking with you, Helen.
Let's go back a bit. Tell us some of the history of the Franklin River and how you became associated with it and familiar with it, and what led you to sit in a tree in your suit.
Well, as a 20-something year old, I came from Sydney down to the island state of Tasmania off the south edge of the Australian continent because I got an offer of a job as a young doctor, as a family doctor in the second city of Launceston. And I wanted to look at a magnificent lake called Lake Pedder, which was being flooded for a hydroelectric works at the time, and also to look for the Tasmanian tiger, this large marsupial animal with stripes on its back, about the size of a tiger, which there were still sightings of, although the last one had died in a zoo in Tasmania in 1936, some 36 years earlier. So down I came, and 4 years later I was sitting in the surgery when, I just left it and was at the local library when a forester asked me if I'd raft down the Franklin River. I'd never heard of it, but I went with him and spent 14 days, magical days, in wild country, massive gorges, canyons, waterfalls, platypuses swimming in the river, eagles overhead, an ancient Huon pine forest, some of those trees 3,000 years old. And when we got to the end of it, we ran into helicopters and jackhammers and explosions where they were trying to find an anchorage place in the gorge to build a dam to flood the whole lot. So I knew I had to do something about this river along with Paul Smith, the forester, and got involved in the campaign. And it took 7 years, and it ended up with they moved the bulldozers in for a massive dam building effort in 1982. And it ended up with the blockade, 1,500 people arrested, 500 of us went to jail. But at the consequent national elections, the government was changed. In came a government led by then Prime Minister Hawke, and he, true to his election commitment, put a halt to the dam works.
So you used what Jefferson said, I guess, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion, right?
Yes, indeed. And that was something we very much got from the American ethos. In fact, Ralph Nader, the then great consumer advocate, came to Tasmania at that time and talked about the need for freedom of information legislation, which, of course, we didn't have, and how information was the currency of democracy. And it was partly opening up the dam building organisation called the Tasmanian Hydroelectric Commission to the scrutiny of citizens, its books, its failure to provide good alternatives, the environmental damage that it was going to do if it had built that dam, that we were able to persuade the public of Australia to become campaigners.
And Senator Bob Brown, did you find any fraud or corruption within the Hydroelectric Commission at all?
Well, interestingly, a lecturer from Berkeley in California sailed his yacht to Tasmania at the time. He had been involved in protesting about oil drilling off the west coast of California, and he was elected into the Tasmanian State Parliament, and he looked at that very process and said, really, the politicians of the day weren't taking bribes. They didn't have the brains to put their hands out. What we really found, and I've found so much in politics, is that you get politicians who have very little worldly experience going to business lunches with big corporations and vested interests who know much more about the world and promise that they'll, if only their project gets up, the populace will love it at the next election. And you get weak-brained, I don't want to be too harsh about it, but certainly politicians lacking in courage who simply say yes and then get themselves into the most unpopular, awful messes over that. And we have had allegations of corruption in Tasmania and elsewhere in Australia over developments, as you get much around the world, and that's why it is so true that freedom of information, the ability to throw the spotlight into the dark corners of the meetings that are held in back rooms is very, very healthy thing for democracy.
Well, we did pass the Freedom of Information Act, did we not, Senator Brown?
Yes, Australia passed an act under the Conservative government of Malcolm Fraser in 1983, I think, but I was then elected to the Tasmanian Parliament. In fact, I came the day I came out of Risdon Jail after the Franklin protest. I was elected into the local state parliament.
How wonderful.
Yeah, and 10 years later, was able to bring in the first freedom of and the best Freedom of Information Act in Australia. So that's something I certainly inherited from the campaign and was able to brought the, not only the dam itself was protected, but it was a case of giving other citizens information on a whole range of things to help them in their campaign for social justice, for better democracy, for the environment, whatever it might be in consequent years.
I'm interviewing Senator Bob Brown, who's a physician, who is one of our major senators in the federal parliament in Australia, in Canberra. Senator Brown, you were talking about, you know, big businessmen and corporate types, and they persuade politicians to do thus, thus and thus, which happens all the time in Australia. But in fact, I think we've discussed this, that from a scientific and medical perspective, they're not very well informed either. Would that be correct?
Well, very much so. I mean, the current debate about climate change, which Australia has the world's worst pollution per head of population of the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, we're substantially worse than the United States of America under George Bush, which is saying something, because we have enormous coal reserves and because we're logging and burning forests in Australia. It's not the dry outback land that many people would think of, and Tasmania in particular has concentrated large areas of forest, as does southeast Australia. And big businesses here have been able to successfully lobby the last government of John Howard, a great friend of George W. Bush's, and now the current government, Labor government, of Kevin Rudd into holding right back in the traces, and instead of dealing with that pollution, which is going to bring huge economic hardship as well as environmental hardship to our grandchildren, instead of taking the action we can so easily take to have a drastic reduction in those greenhouse gas output instead of without harming our lifestyle, we've got so many politicians simply blocking moves to take that course of action. And by the way, it's now recognised by leading world economists that those countries which take the environmental lead in this century are going to be the countries with the healthiest economies and the best job prospects. And it's good to see President-elect Obama becoming part of the so-called New Green Deal with several European leaders, because it is the right way to go, and it is going to help economies, not just the environment, in the decades ahead.
Well, so, Senator Brown, our new Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, is an intelligent man. He's also a Christian. What is your explanation as a physician, looking at him from a psychological perspective, of why he is taking this track towards, I guess, desecration of the planet by invoking more and more greenhouse gases from Australia's coal and forests, and listening to the corporate types instead of using his own wisdom, his own knowledge, and his own spiritual ethos to do the right thing for his children and his grandchildren? How could you explain that?
Well, it's very tough to explain it, but there is a denial mechanism at play here. The problem, why deny what's going to happen a decade or two down the line if you can just concentrate on the next election, which is just 2 years away? And you can always rationalise as well, Helen, and say, well, the other party, the Conservatives, were even worse. We're better than them. We're a little bit better. Therefore, the Australian electorate will support us. I just find it incredibly frustrating And, of course, the coal industry, which is currently embedded in the Australian delegation to Poznan in Poland, where global talks on climate change are taking place at the moment.
Is it really? Is it
yes,
really?
Yes, and always has been on both the major parties, much like the oil industry is with American delegations, and the logging industry is there as well. And the environmentalists don't have that relationship,
access.
And they're outside that fold to a big degree. So I think there is this human thing of wanting to believe what the last person told you. And, of course, when you get to become a senior politician, the last person is nearly always a representative of some corporate entity. And so the 80% of Australians want much more climate change action. 80% of its elected politicians are holding back the changes that need to take place. And it's the impact of the lobbying of vested interests, something I think President Cleveland spoke about a century ago, that we had to stop this creeping influence of corporate lobbyists. I think he'd be turning in his grave if he could see what's happening now.
Yes. I'm speaking to Senator Bob Brown. He's the head of the Green Party in Australia, and he's also a physician. Let's go back just briefly, Bob, to your trip down the Franklin River. I think probably many Americans don't really understand what a platypus is. Could you describe the physical attributes of an Australian icon, the platypus?
Well, it was certainly designed by a committee. And the first specimens, when they were sent back to Britain, London, 2 centuries ago, they thought it was a hoax. And the platypus is what's called a monotreme. Its only relative is the echidna, which is Australia's version of the porcupine. Both these animals the two of them together are a unique entity in that they lay eggs. Mm-hmm. They're the only animals that lay eggs. The platypus, moreover, has a duck bill. It's got a bill like a duck up front, only a bit broader. And it's furred. It has a little pouch from which it secretes milk for the youngsters. It lives in burrows by the banks a bit, and it's Australia's version of the beaver.
Mm.
But it comes from a lineage which is very ancient and is only these days found in Australia. And no wonder the scientists couldn't believe it when they saw it. I see them off my front, the bridge at my place at Liffey in Tasmania on the Liffey River of an evening. They come out and they are marvellous characters in the water, and they feed underwater. They turn up rocks and get the little insects and various other organisms that live in the river, and a real icon for most Australians.
Are they a threatened species?
In some of their range, they've been eliminated. They've done very well, but suddenly, lo and behold, the platypuses in my river and elsewhere are facing a disease which causes serious ulceration.
Oh, dear.
And it's thought that may be due to some of the... It may be. I know the forest authorities here would go crook if they could hear this interview. To the tons of chemicals that are put onto the fast-growing monoculture plantations which replace the natural ecosystem forest once they're logged for wood chips, which is out of Tasmania, which is largely, more than 90% of the logging material out of these forests is going to Japan as wood chips to make wrapping paper.
This is Senator Bob Brown, who is the leader of the Australian Greens in the federal parliament and a physician. Senator Brown, you've just come down to a little fishing village where I live to inspect what the forestry department, they call forestry department, but in fact they destroy forests, is doing in this little town right on a river where oysters grow. And you learnt when you came for the visit that there are koalas in this area as well. Can you describe the forest, the wonders of an Australian forest, and talk a little about koalas so that people in America can get a sense of what we have here, which is so precious?
Yes, well, the koalas are a very special marsupial. That means they have their young in a pouch, and as it gets bigger, it crawls onto the mum's back and gets carried through the canopy of forest. They come down onto ground to go from tree to tree, but they eat the eucalypt leaves, and over a long, which is toxic to most other creatures, but over a long period of evolution, they've got to eat from the eucalypt trees, which dominate Australia. They've evolved over the last tens of millions of years since Australia separated off from Antarctica and South America, 60 million years ago. And they were numerous. There was tens of millions of these in Australia, and there was a massive shooting campaign for their furs going right through to the 1920s.
Really? I didn't know that, Bob.
Huge. Went on to the North American and British fur markets, and millions were shot each year, and suddenly they realised there was almost none left. And it was a ban by the United States, by people in the United States who got to know about this, that led to the end of the last massive shootings in Queensland, in Northern Australia, in the 1920s. But they've hung on. There are some hundreds of thousands, hopefully, right along the eastern seaboard. Curiously, they don't occur in Tasmania, but the forests are being cut out from under them. Cities are expanding and taking other forests. We've got dogs and foxes these days, which can grab hold of koalas as they go from one tree to another. And their numbers are continuing to decline rapidly, even though they're the most cute and wonderful animals, and everybody in Australia associates so strongly with them. And when I went down to your town of Bermagui, Helen, and went out to the forest with you, I was just astonished to see the bulldozers in there, the chainsaws had been, they were logging on a steep slope, and in particular, logging the oldest trees. They were doing selective logging there, not clear felling as they do elsewhere, but they were taking the biggest trees. And these, of course, are the nesting sites for a whole range of wildlife, including birds and animals, but the essential habitat for koalas. And this forest was growing back from very destructive clearance and logging 80 or 100 years ago, and it's just getting to the stage where it's going to be prime koala habitat again. The eucalypt trees themselves are very beautiful with their white trunks and very, very ornately patterned and coloured patterns in these white trunks. Fern trees, ferns underneath, and the bush is in flowering mode at the moment because it's spring down under. And yet here we saw this runoff and the mud coming away from the logging site, threatening the pristine river underneath, which, as you say, is oyster-growing country. And we know from past experience that where you pollute rivers with runoff from such operations, you'll lose the natural oysters farming ability, and of course that's threatening the livelihood of people down below. But on the doorstep of a town like Bermagui, Zane Grey country, he came out to fish for marlin, and way back when he was at the top of his writing power, and he found Bermagui, and who'd want to leave it once you found it? Just a spectacular little coastal village with this forest on the doorstep. A magnificent asset. And they're logging it. And it's being exported. A percentage of that's going to, again, to Japan for wrapping papers. But not one tree needs to be removed because Australia has huge plantation resources to meet all its wood needs and doesn't need to be logging any native forest at all. And yet...
Would you like then, Senator Brown, to quickly address the findings of the IPCC report, the International Panel on Climate Change, and James Hansen's work, the godfather of global warming, so-called, about the significance of trees and forests to the ongoing global warming problem?
Well, in short, if we were to stop logging of native forests around the world from the Amazon to North America indeed, and the Indonesia, Central Africa, and your state of New South Wales and Australia, my state of Tasmania, we'd reduce the rate of very dangerous pollution of the atmosphere with greenhouse gases by 18 to 20% overnight. I mean, it would be a massive contribution towards saving this beautiful planet, which is threatened with cataclysmic climate change for our grandchildren. We're seeing the changes already. We've seen the massive hurricanes and cyclones that are now becoming so much more, and tornadoes, which are becoming so much more frequent, the big storms, the much more damaging hailstorms we've seen here in Australia, bushfires, drought across the Murray-Darling system in Australia, which is the main food-producing basin. That's happening elsewhere in the world. And this climate change is the biggest problem common to humanity at the moment, along with the need for us to do something about nuclear weapons. And yet, we are continuing in a wealthy country like Australia to contribute to it unnecessarily by destroying forests. These are the biggest carbon banks. That means they're holding greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, and as they grow, they hold out more. And yet the logging industry is serially logging and burning these forests and making the problem worse. It is stupendous negligence. And James Hansen, of course, has been warning Congress in the United States about this since 1988, in the most clear, concise and unrefuted terms. But our politicians in Australia have had the same information available, and yet the vested interests, the money interests, are able to keep such processes going. And we as citizens, wherever we are in the world, have to not vote for such people who don't make the stand that's required for our grandchildren. I measure everything in politics by this simple dictum: will our grandchildren thank us for doing this? And if you can't be sure and say yes to that, you shouldn't be doing it. And that's why we shouldn't be logging forests, native forests, anywhere on the planet.
Well, of course, it happens in America. And when I see how we in the Western world use paper, we use paper to dry our hands, paper towels, we use paper serviettes for dinner instead of linen napkins. We use, look at one issue of the Sunday New York Times, how many forests go into making that Sunday New York Times, and most of it's thrown away. We use paper, I mean, I don't mind using paper for the toilet, for instance, but I think everything else needs to be judiciously looked at. I mean, we wipe the tears off our babies' faces with trees instead of doing it with cloth. Kleenex tissues, they should be banned. Everywhere I look, paper is being used, and it's helping to destroy the planet through the exacerbation of global warming. Would you say that, Bob?
Yeah, but even, you know, if we didn't log native forests, a lot of those materials are coming out of plantations, and the best thing we could do would be allow those plantations to grow and absorb more carbon. Mm. But even on a rotation basis, we have enough in the world. For instance, there's plantations the size of Tasmania, which is the same size as Ireland, in South America, growing up now to simply make paper. And you're quite right, a lot of that is simply being then thrown into rubbish tips, where it turns into
CO2,
methane and other greenhouse gases, yeah, which is blighting the future, which is a great threat to our grandchildren. We all have to be much more thoughtful about that, but we need politicians, this is how democracies work, to make the rules the same for everybody. And we should just simply tax pollution. That would and Europe, Sweden in particular, is now moving towards taxing the use of resources and those who create pollution, rather than simply having income taxes. And it means the bigger impact you have on the environment, the more you pay in taxes,
yeah,
which is a clever system for both raising money and helping the planet while we're at it.
Because we really use the atmosphere as the sewage system, don't we? Just expel whatever we want into it and the seas. I just probably... As a physician, I want you to comment, and I've got my own views about this, but disposable diapers, we call them napkins in Australia for babies, all made of trees with plastic on the outside, and they are bleached white, so there may be dioxin in the paper which could be absorbed through the baby's skin, which is a potent carcinogen. Would you just like to, I can't remember the 22 million diapers used every day, I think, in the United States and thrown away. And, of course, the resultant excreta can enter the water systems of a town containing E. coli and other bacteria instead of using cloth diapers or napkins as I did when I had three babies. Would you like to just comment on that from a medical and scientific perspective, Bob?
Well, yes, I would. It is, and people have to be very careful with any such throwaway goods and have to be able to think this is going to end up in the local river or the local lake. And we all have to, I've got a little sign over the sink from Greenpeace saying, remember what goes out of this sink goes into the ocean.
Mm.
Where these days there's 40,000 pieces of plastic per square mile.
Really?
I mean, worldwide.
Really?
On average. And that's where we need to change the whole political setup to have in place elect parliaments, people who will say, we will end that. We can end that. That's unnecessary. We don't need 6 billion plastic bags a year going into the environment in Australia. There's simply, there's so much we can do without changing our lifestyle. In fact, improving our income stream, if only we had the leaders who had the planet in mind and our grandchildren in mind instead of the next election and the next vested interest through the door in mind. And that's an essential change that has to happen very rapidly if we're going to be proud of ourselves in handing on the baton of life to the next generation.
Wasn't it an American Indian, and I can't remember his name, who said, we never make a move without considering the implications for the next seven generations.
Yes, there's so much wisdom in that.
Yeah.
And we, the Indigenous people of Australia, feel the same way. We simply have to get back to being happy with ourselves through community agreements that says we can live with what we've got and we can recycle, we can reuse, we can redesign, we can have a buoyant economy, but we just have to reset the parameters upon which it runs from living off the planet to living with the planet. When we all do that, we'll have a smile back on our faces.
Well, Senator Brown, I'd like to thank you very much for this interview. It's been a great joy and honour to have you today. And I'd just like to tell people that Senator Brown is probably one of the heroes of Australian politics. He's almost a saint in his dedication to help to save Australia and indeed the planet. And thank you very much, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you for all you've done and you are doing. And I'll continue to work with you to try and save that fantastic forest at Bermagui.
Okay, you're on, Bob.
Okay.
Thank you.
All the best.
Today I've been speaking with Bob Brown, author and longtime environmental activist and leader of the Australian Greens, the third largest political party in Australia. Today's discussion has been a fascinating juxtaposition between a journalist and political commentator on the one hand and a political senator from Australia on the other hand, both discussing the major issues facing the planet and humankind at this point in time. Thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.